When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Save big on your Memorial Day barbecue, all in the Kroger app. Get 3-pound rolls of juicy 80% lean ground beef for $3.49 a pound with a digital coupon. Then get select varieties of flavorful Powerade, Body Armor Super Drink, or Arizona Tea for 77 cents each, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This show is brought to you by The Makery, the podcast network for makers.
Welcome to Knife Talk. Unfortunately, Craig has lost his voice, so we were unable to record this week. So today we are going to get to know the hosts by replaying some of their early interviews. Enjoy.
Today I'll be speaking with Jeff Fader of Fader Knives, and like me, Jeff mainly makes knives for the kitchen. So I'm keen to learn more about his processes. So hey Jeff, welcome to the show.
Craig, this is a real pleasure.
Good to hear. Now,
I can't even believe it that I'm on number three. I listened to the podcast number one with Walter Sorrells, incredible. I listened to Alex Steele number two, incredible. And now here's the drop off of Knife Talk. Incredible precipitous drop off.
Some great warm up acts. This is your moment.
Oh, yeah, you're killing me, but that's fine. I'm with you. This is unbelievable.
So let's try and set the scene. I tried to do this at the beginning of each episode. So, are you in your workshop at the moment?
No, I'm not. I'm in the house.
Okay.
I'm in a quiet room.
Is your workshop at home?
I have two workshops. I have a workshop at home, and I'm building a new shop about a mile and a half from my home.
Oh, very nice. Very nice.
Yeah.
Very nice. So is there much of a knife-making community where you live?
Well, here in the United States, I'm in New York State, which is I'm about an hour north of New York City and where I grew up. And there's a lot of blacksmiths, and there are a number of knife makers in the Hudson Valley.
Yeah.
The blacksmithing and the blade community have been really growing, and a lot of it is people be able to see it through Instagram and social media and stuff like that. But there are a number of really high level guys in the Northeast of the United States.
Yeah, yeah. And why do you think that is? Why do you think it's growing at such a rate? I've discussed this before on previous episodes, and everybody seems to come up with this with a similar sort of theme. And I'm just wondering, curious about your opinions on that.
Well, it's interesting. Be honest with you, I started out as a sculptor. I was a steel sculptor, metal worker, and then I ended up working for a blacksmith shop. It's called now Fine Architectural Metalsmiths, which is connected to Center for Metal Arts, which is one of the best blacksmith learning schools in the Northeast.
Right.
And when I was there 10, 15 years ago, there was really social media really hadn't kicked in yet. And I was working under a lot of blacksmiths by the name of Uri Hoffey and Fred Christ and John Ledford. And these were guys who were, they were incredible wealth of information, but you were seeing blacksmiths that were just there. You weren't seeing a lot of new guys. It seemed like it was a dying business. And one of the things was with blacksmithing, especially, was there's an organization called ABANA in the United States. And at the time, when I joined 15 years ago, there was only 3,000 members, 3,000 plus members. And with the rise of social media and people seeing what's going on with blacksmiths and now bladesmiths and with the show Forged in Fire, you're getting a real, you're seeing a lot more tool makers, hammer makers, and craftsmen, especially in the United States. And it's incredible. It's fascinating.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, from my point of view, I think, well, I mean, I've been making things all my life, but the last sort of 15 years, they've been digital things. And,
right.
they're not tangible. They don't last. My portfolio is gone within 6 months. But I love sort of the whole thing of getting something in your hand, making it and feeling it, and making something that you can use daily as well, you know? And I think maybe more and more people are feeling that way, maybe.
I think there's something to that. I mean, for me, I was an art major, and when I was a kid, I wasn't allowed to have certain toys that I wanted. My father showed me how to use bandsaws and tools and stuff like that. So I was making a lot of my own toys at a young age, and, you know, swords and bows and arrows and all that stuff.
And the dangerous fun stuff.
For sure. But yeah. In the beginning, I had certain things that I wanted to make. But then what happened was it wasn't really about the thing that I was going to make, but it was the journey of making something new.
Yes.
And when I became a sculptor and I went to art school, it was about creating something and then presenting it. And then I was a chef, I was a cook, and, you know, it was the same thing. You're taking raw ingredients and you're using proper techniques and you're giving it to someone you care about, whether it's making a knife or making food or making sculpture. The buzz that you get from creating something is palpable. And I used to say, when I used to make sculpture, I make these giant fishing lures out of wood and steel and stuff like that. I used to say to people that when you're a sculptor or you're a maker, It doesn't really matter. You could be on a deserted island with no hope of rescue, and you'd still be compelled to make what you want to make. And it's a compulsion. It has to be a compulsion.
Yes, yeah. And I suppose with a background as a chef and a blacksmith, making blades,
it's
inevitable, isn't it?
Close to the chef. I got a little bit too gun. I shot from the hip with the chef thing. I went to culinary school, but I was never a chef. I was a cook for a long time, and I work with a lot of chefs, which is a lot of fun. My partner's a chef. But I got a little bit ahead of myself, Craig. I apologize.
So when did it become a job for you? When did you think, this is going to pay the bills? This is going to, you know, this is going to keep my family happy. This is going to be what I need to be doing.
Well, we're still in the make the family happy stage. I was a sculptor for a long time, 20 years, and I had galleries and I was working on stuff. And basically what happened was I was helping at this, a friend of mine, John Ledford, started a school called the Hudson Valley Ironworks. And we were bringing a lot of knife makers like Matt Paul of MP Knives and Darren Fisher, who's an incredible blacksmith. And we would have blacksmiths and jewelers. And I was teaching sculpture classes. And I started helping with Matt Paul, who does incredible bushcraft knives. And I had a history of forging knives and forging, you know, ornamental ironwork. And yeah. I was a busy blacksmith for quite a while. And I just started fooling around. When you're forging knives, when you're forging anything, you can always usually have a couple things in the oven. So, or in the forge, I should say. And it was easy for me while I was working on some railings to have a couple knives to fool around and kind of work out, you know, the proper way, the best way for me to do knives. And then all of a sudden I started getting commissions, and I kept it very quiet with my wife because I didn't want her to think I was crazy. And I started making more, you know, hunting the style knives and then forging, you know, do like brute to forge style knives.
Yeah.
And then I started getting commissions, and then it came to the point where I was getting so many commissions that it was hard for me to just not go to the next step. And I approached my good friend Tony Ayazi, who used to be the executive chef at Oriole and now owns this great computer company, a tech company called Shoebox. And I needed help, and he stepped in and became my partner. And we're still at the growing stage in terms of, we have a payroll company and we're paying each other and we're paying rent on places and paying lawyers and paying all this stuff. But we're not, knives aren't sending me to the beach.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? We're still in the growing stages, but it's been really great.
Yeah, and it's that thing, isn't it? How will that scale, you know? Hand making a beautiful knife, you know, how do you scale that?
Well, right at this point now, I'm doing everything. And I've always really felt like, I mean, I'm not, I feel like I'm still young as a knife maker, for sure. And that's the best part. The best part is, you know, meeting and talking to other knife makers. I'm really excited. I'm going to the Blade Show in Atlanta in a couple months, and I'm meeting really, really amazing bladesmiths. And I'm really the idea that I'm going to be growing is I'm on a journey. I'm on my own journey, and the level that I'm at, and I'm looking forward to getting better and better and better. And every knife you make, you know, and every knife you make, you pick something new up and you make it better. And it's just it's it's an incredible journey. And I just, a real quick story, really, this is a good story. Yesterday I went to this place, this famous restaurant supply store for chefs. It's called J.B. Prince. And I was there with my partner, and we were there with a couple other people, and we were looking, and we saw they have incredible knives from all over the place. But a lot of them are, you know, company made knives, Hank's Willings and all that. Yeah. And then there was this one knife there from Mariko Momasi. I hope I'm saying his name right. Momasi Fire Arts. And it was sitting on this wooden block in the case, and it was just stunning to the point where I started to get blue. I started to get a little bit blue because just like, this guy is just top of the line. It was an integral chef's knife, which, you know, an integral chef's knife is where the bolsters part of the blades forged through and the bolsters kind of forged into the blade. And I was reading this little note, and it was this clean knife. It had curly koa, and everything was slick, and it looked like just a beautiful steel knife and everything like that. Nothing special. I saw a little hamon in it, and it was just, you know, beautiful. And then there was this note on it, and the note said, "Well, this is Mariko's knife, blah blah blah." He's giving me all the details, and then it says, "This is a Damascus knife." And then all of a sudden I read a Damascus knife, and I'm looking at the knife, and it's shiny, it's got, you know, the hand buffed, it doesn't look like I see like a carbon steel knife with a hamon.
Yeah.
And then I keep reading, and all of a sudden I have this, I can't believe it. What he did was he made it so clean, and he didn't etch the blade,
right? Yeah.
So his idea was that when you work it, you know, when you're the natural use of this knife will reveal the Damascus.
Ah, right.
So, like,
yeah.
So it's like, instead of the whole idea, a lot of people get bummed out when they have a carbon steel chef's knife, and they're bummed out when it starts to patina. He's changed the whole idea. Well, he might not be, I've never seen it before. And so when you're using a knife during daily use, it just, you slowly reveal the Damascus. And I'm just like, God, this is incredible and fantastic. And I'm telling my partner, and I'm looking at it, and I'm showing him, I'm saying, you see that? And this is what's going to happen. And then next to me, there's this guy, this cook who's been overhearing us. And he just kind of gets closer to me and he goes, "Hey, you like that knife?" And I said, "Yeah, it's incredible." And I'm just like losing my mind over this knife. And he goes, "I got something better for you. You got to go down to," and then he named another store, and he says, "You got to go down there, man, because there's a knife with a white handle." And he gets closer as he's speaking quietly. He's looking over his shoulder. He says, this knife is unbelievable. It's so nice. You're going to see it and you're going to get an erection. And I immediately thought it just like completely shut the whole conversation. It was really funny because what he was basically saying was he had no real concept of, you know, that level of knife, but he was just trying to involve himself. And it was this very odd New York moment, but it was amazing because I was looking at the incredible craftsmanship of, you know, this incredible knife from Mariko. And then this guy was like trying to sell me on a white handled Zwilling, something like that. It was pretty funny.
But that's a really interesting concept of that, of Damascus unetched and letting it reveal its beauty over time.
Never seen it before.
It would make you want to use the item more, which is brilliant.
Well, I mean, that was the whole thing. I mean, you're totally reversing the idea of how do I keep it so it doesn't do that? And then it's almost like you want to work it harder to force the etch by cooking. And it was just like fascinating, but it was like, it made me blue in the beginning because it was just like, God damn, my knives will never be this nice. And then all of a sudden at the end, I was like, I'm looking forward to making, you know, the more I make, the better I get, and seeing this is going to inspire me to work harder for the next one.
Yes, yeah, yeah. So let's talk a bit about process. So of all the many processes involved in making a great knife, you know, steel selection, the forging, the profiling, grinding, all the rest of it, what's your favorite and what's your least part of making a knife?
That is an awesome question. because I started out doing a lot of forge knives, and now I'm starting to get back into doing more forge knives, and with the new shop and I'm having a power hammer built, I plan on doing more Damascus, and I did some Damascus with Aaron Wilburn of Wilburn Forge. The part I love the best is, I would say, I don't know. You know, I like talking to my customers, because the way my business is a little bit different than a lot of guys is we have a conversation and I really try to make customized knives for the particular customer. So
yeah.
We do a consultation and then I'll really kind of go with what you want to do. And I really enjoy meeting the customer and talking to the customer before I even made anything. I also do a lot of watercolors beforehand so I can get some colors, you know, squared away. Mm. I really enjoy that. I'm not crazy about the hand sanding because, you know, and I'm not crazy about dealing with plunge lines, but, other than that, I love working with the customer. That's my favorite part, is having a relationship with the customer and trying to make them something that they've envisioned, something that they want, and something that I could provide. And I like heat treating too. I like heat treating. That's the scary part for me, you know. If you're doing a stainless steel and you're putting in between two pieces of aluminum with some compressed air and hoping it's flat, or you know, you're bringing your knife up to 1500 and hoping that when you dunk it into your oil it doesn't warp. You know, there's a little bit of nervousness there that's it's always very exciting.
Yes, yeah. And do you generally use one kind of steel, like 1095, D2, or stainless? Or do you just, whatever the job needs, you'll use whatever you think is best for that job?
When I started, I used a lot. When I was forging knives, I started with a lot of 1095.
Yeah.
And it just became very easy for me to get a hold of. And then a lot of my customers wanted stainless steel. So I was getting 440C stainless steel, and I've fooled around a little bit with some other stainless steels. And then, you know, with Damascus, obviously you're getting, you know, into that 15N.
Yeah. Okay. So. Like most creatives, you probably got many other creative outlets out there. And I know sort of offline, you've told me about a few of those, but what do you get up to when you're not making knives?
Well, I was formerly trained as a sculptor, and I do a lot of wood carving. I do these, when I was in college, I started doing all these giant fishing lures. So I do these giant fishing lure sculptures. And it's, you know, totally different mechanics, but it's the same outline in terms of, like, you have an idea and then you kind of cut it out and then carve. You have your plan and then you kind of execute. So yeah. I do a lot of these giant lure sculptures, and that's something that I've always loved to do. And, you know, I feel like it's gotten me ready to make knives, you know. And it's also map groups. My last project was I did a installation of 60 needlefish lures, and I had a friend who was a bronze caster, and he was knocking out a lot of casts of bronze sculptures. And then what he would do was he was telling me that you just have to recast them. And I, just to give it to him, I decided that I was going to carve and paint 60 identical fishing lure sculptures. So it was total madness. It drove me crazy. It was just really difficult, but it allowed me, you know, the mindset to actually do knives in batches. So like now I do these chef signature series knives where I collaborate with a chef, and then we'll design something. And then what we'll do is we'll sell a set of 12 limited series, and then I'll make all 12 at the same time. So actually doing the sculptures, the 60 needlefish, allowed me it gave me like the blueprint for making sculptures in making knives in batches, which was a huge help.
Yeah. Okay. And I've been looking at them today actually on Instagram, and they look fantastic. Really?
Yeah, they're fun. They're fun.
Cool.
I actually started doing those because I had a studio in Greenpoint, Brooklyn, back in after I graduated college, and it was a welding shop, and it was a very dark and, you know, gray, and then I started doing these little painted wooden sculptures to kind of brighten the place up a little bit. So actually that color kind of fits into, I really like for the handles of my chef knives, especially, I really like high contrast colors.
Yes.
So I've been doing with a lot of high contrast colors, which have, you know, harkens back to the days of being an artist, I think.
Now, today I'll be speaking with the maker of some of the most beautiful chef knives that I've ever seen. It's the incredible Mareko Malmasi. So welcome to the show, Mareko. How are you?
Hi, I'm doing well, Craig. Hi, how are you doing? It's a pleasure to be on, and I really appreciate you inviting me to come and have a chat with you.
Yeah, well, again, thank you for taking the time out. So you in the shop today?
I am in the shop today. I did find a nice quiet spot for me to have a conversation with you, which is kind of difficult when I'm sharing the space with three other makers who are all doing their own kind of thing. But
you know, Hide their hammers. Yeah. That's the best way.
There's a lot of them.
So for those that don't know of your work, can you explain to the listeners what you do?
Yeah, so I specialize, let me back up a little bit. I'm a bladesmith, which means I actually forge my blades. But I actually got my start doing stock removal, which I think is a great place for a lot of people to start. But I specialize in kitchen knives, culinary knives. The reason that I focus on culinary knives, one is because when I got my start, I worked for a culinary knife maker who I believe has been on your show actually before, Bob Kramer.
Oh, I think I've heard of the guy. Yeah, I think I've heard of him.
Yeah, yeah. And it's the knife I know the best. Yeah. So I worked in kitchens myself for off and on, jumping between jobs for about 7 years. And so out of all the different kind of edged tools that I could make that take the form of a knife, culinary knives are the ones that I know the best. I know from my own experience, how they should feel, weigh, balance. And you know, that's of course based off my perspective, but, you know, it's the product that I feel like I could stand behind the best.
Yeah. And I mean, speaking to the, you know, makers of chef knives, which I've done, you know, quite a few on the show, they've made specifically chef knives. They've all had a background in professional kitchens, you know? So it's a tool that they're used to handling.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think realistically for anybody to make a tool as best as it possibly can, it helps for them to have experience using that tool. It would make no sense for me to make fly fishing rods. I don't know how to fly fish, you know? And so there you go.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you've already mentioned that you trained, you know, with the master, Bob Kramer. So how did you manage that? How did you get that gig?
That was actually just absolutely sheer pure luck. I was actually working in a restaurant at the time, as well as moonlighting as an assistant salsa dancing instructor slash community performer slash whatever. And I had a friend who worked for him, who had just started working for him, helping him with his book work and orders and organizing a little bit in his office space. And this is just before his article in the New Yorker came out in 2008. And so she started working for him. I was working a job that I was not very happy in. I was working with her, and I said, you know, I don't know what the hell I'm doing with myself. I'm 24 years old and I feel like I have absolutely no direction. And she's like, oh, you should meet this guy that I just started working for. He's really interesting. I think you guys would get on really well. You know, he's been all over the world. He even was a clown at one point in his life. And she's like, yeah, he's a bladesmith. And I was like, what the hell does that mean? He's a bladesmith. She's like, well, you know, it's like blacksmithing, but he makes knives. And I just with the most puzzled look on my face, I'm sure. I was like, people still do that? Like, I had absolutely no idea. And she's like, yeah, and it's great. He makes really great stuff, but I think you guys would get along really well. So let's get that going. And so we worked it out, and we ended up actually meeting at the pub I was working at. And over a couple beers and some fish and chips, we chatted about life a little bit. And I was kind of just at a lot, like I said, at a loss. And she thought that he could help me with, from his own experience of being all over the place and whatnot, help bestow some wisdom, I guess, upon me. And it ended up being transitioning into an interview in a way. And by the end of our conversation, he offered me an opportunity to work in his shop. And I think I recognize now that that's because he was anticipating a major influx of interest in his work, and he was already backlogged at the time. Mm. And so, and this article in the New Yorker was coming out, and it would be idiotic to not take orders when that happens. And so he was looking for somebody to pull into the shop and to help, even if it was just to help keep things clean, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So how long did that last? How long were you working with Bob?
Yeah, I worked for Bob for 3 years, almost exactly. 2 years and 11 and a half months or something like that.
Yeah. Oh, nice.
And
nice.
Yeah, I worked for him for almost 3 years.
Yeah. So it's always been kitchen knives for you then. So the first knife that you made would have been a kitchen knife, and just it's what you've always done.
Yeah, actually, so the first knife I ever actually made was a kind of hunting slash like fighting knife for my brother. He had just joined the military, and he was graduating from basic training at the time. And that was the very first knife I ever made. And then from then on out, it's pretty much been culinary knives with the hunting knife slash non-culinary knife here and there, yeah. Even letter openers from time to time.
Yeah. So what, in your opinion, makes for a great kitchen knife? I mean, let's talk, you know, a standard sort of chef knife.
Well, I think – so opinions – and excuse my language, but I think the old adage is opinions are like assholes. Everybody's got one, and everybody thinks everybody else's stinks. And the reality is that for everybody out there in the world, they have their own opinion based on the ergonomics of their own bodies, their own preferences, the experiences they had cooking with their grandmothers, or the experiences they have from going to culinary school and working professionally for several years, to somebody who is just an enthusiast at home. So in that same way, I build my knives based off my experience. And so for me, I like a medium long length, so around 9 inches, or I think that's about 220 millimeters or so, which is, I think, just under 9. But and I like a nice distal taper with a little bit of flexibility out at the tip, especially for a chef's knife. You know, realistically, that a chef's knife is a general purpose knife that is designed, or ideally designed, to at least in the Western ideology, to cover a series of tasks that might be all the way down to where you might use a utility knife or a small petty, all the way up to big slicing or breaking down of proteins or large fruits and vegetables. So nice and flexible out at like the outer, the last third out to the tip, and to back of the heel, the first, I don't know, maybe a couple inches or so, with a little bit more beef so that it can withstand some press cutting through chicken bones, or, you know, I do press cuts through dry bamboo chopsticks just to get a feel for how the edge geometry feels back at that area. Because like I said, the chef's knife ultimately covers a large portion of the spectrum, I guess, of tasks that you might be doing in your preparation work for cooking.
Yeah.
And then when it comes to handle, I like a nice, highly contoured handle, something that feels really comfortable in my hand. And I think that perspective comes especially from my experience working for Bob. His handles are very highly contoured, really nice feeling, handle shapes. Most of the commercial stuff that you might find out there usually has some sort of flats or something like that, which is fine. But for me, I really like a nice contoured handle that feels like I'm shaking somebody's hand. I want it to be a natural extension of me, because realistically, the relationship that we have with the business end of the knife is through that handle. And in my working in kitchens and restaurants, it was a lot of prep work, a lot of standing, chopping, dicing, slicing, breaking down stuff, and preparing foods for hours on end. And it has to feel comfortable for you to be able to want to do that for long periods of time. And I hated it. And part of that reason is because I hated holding on to the knives. It just was not as enjoyable and comfortable as I thought it could be.
And so it really sort of index then, doesn't it? Index into your hands. So you've got a nice sort of comfortable but solid grip. Yeah.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Okay. So, I mean, a lot of makers are concentrating solely on maybe Japanese designs, but yours definitely have more of a sort of Western or a European aesthetic, particularly on the handles. So,
yeah.
I mean, that's my favorite style too, but are you often asked to make sort of Japanese-inspired designs and things that you're not particularly comfortable with?
I'm actually really comfortable with all the different styles and designs. I actually get a pretty even request for Western style blades and Japanese inspired blades. Because like I said, everybody has their own preferences and as to what they're comfortable with using. And I, when I talk to a customer, on top of discussing, trying to figure out, you know, what are they actually using the knife for so that I could tailor the geometry a little bit towards that. I tell them, you know, this is their opportunity to kind of design a knife, themselves. And I consider myself a kind of tailor of cutlery in that way, that I can make the blade a little wider or a little longer or an odd length or a very specific kind of grind. I can do pretty much any kind of grind, any kind of handle shape. I can shrink the handle. I can make it larger if you have larger hands. I do gravitate towards the Japanese inspired style knives a little bit more, as I like them, in the fact that the geometry, or I guess not necessarily geometry, but the blade, the edge profile, I really like that a lot. My Western style knives do have a very kind of German chef's knife profile. But that also comes from my experience working with Bob. But one of the things I always hated about, or I guess not hated, but strongly disliked about European style chef's knives, is they always have a really steep curve up to the tip at the outer end.
Yeah,
of the knife.
That sort of rocker. And, yes, yeah.
Yeah, and I still have that in my knives, but they emulate more of a Japanese cutting profile, where you can still rock the blade up high enough to chop, you know, rock chop something that's 2 to 2.5 inches tall, without the tip of the blade digging into the board. But it also allows you easier access to the tip if you are going to, again, use that general purpose knife to do some work that maybe you might typically reach for a utility knife to do. And that was part of the reason I've specifically designed that edge profile. Both in my Western style inspired and Japanese inspired blades. Mm.
And I really like what you said there about that sort of tailored approach as well. And that does carry through on your site, doesn't it? So you ask a series of questions and then you go to work on a design. I really like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you're...
Yeah, I think... Oh, sorry.
Sorry, after you.
Yeah, yeah. I was just going to say, you know, I think it's a very rare opportunity for people to really get a chance. I mean, that's the purpose of a custom knife, right? It's them designing the knife, a customer designing them their knives, to fit themselves, to be custom fit for them. And especially people who have a lot of experience, they have very specific things that they like or wish that they had, or wish were features in a knife that they've never experienced, which is the same perspective kind of that I came from. And the reason I've designed my knives the way that I do, is because essentially it's a series of things that I was like, damn it, I wish this, that, and the other thing were different on this knife. And then when I started making my own, I was able to put those into the knife, those design features. And you know, there are a lot of people who don't necessarily know what they want, and they lean on me a little bit more for advice. And that's when I start talking to them about, you know, like I had a customer, actually a perfect example. They're saying, you know, I'm interested in, I like, or sorry, they said, I like the Nikkiri and a Santoku, but I also, you know, I like the Western style. And I'm like, well, how do you cut with the knife? Mm. Are you doing press cuts or push cuts or pull draw cuts? If that's the case, then the curry is going to be great. But if you do a lot of rock chopping in your cooking or in your prep work for your cooking, then the curry is going to be absolutely worthless to you because it's pretty much an almost entirely flat cutting mm-hmm. edge that abruptly turns at an angle down at the tip.
Save big money on plant protection supplies now at Menards. Defend your garden with Triazicide Insect Killer. Its fast-acting formula protects lawns, vegetables, and many other plants. It kills more than 260 insects by contact, above and below ground. Choose from ready-to-spray, concentrate, or granular. Save big money on Triazicide Insect Killer at Menards. And check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
But if that's the case, if you do more rock chopping, maybe a Santoku or more of a Kyoto profile is going to, you know, suit you better, as well as, you know, what kind of materials are you actually cutting? Are you vegetarian? You're never going to come into contact with bones. Then great. Like, I can take the edge geometry a little bit thinner for you because, you know, you don't have to worry about the edge being deflected off anything super hard that could potentially chip the material out or damage the cutting edge. And then also, you know, if somebody doesn't have as much experience with a knife and they are an enthusiast at home and they're looking for something that when they come home from their job as a lawyer or whatever they do professionally to cook, they want a knife that's going to help encourage that experience and make it as joyful and as pleasurable as they want or as it can be without it being a chore, right?
Mm, yeah, and, definitely, yeah.
But if they have less experience with taking care of or maintaining especially a high carbon steel knife, because they have a tendency to be a bit harder than a stainless steel knife or most stainless steel knives, then I will actually leave the edge geometry just a pinch heftier to help encourage more strength or, I guess, more support behind that leading edge for them, because there's more likely to be accidental misuse or contact with things that could damage.
Yeah, so a bit more forgiving, I suppose. Edge. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so let's talk about your Damascus patterns. I mean, they're probably the best that I've seen. So I know that you do your thing once a week where you sort of drill down the pattern and you show how it's being made and that kind of thing.
Sure.
Do you have a favorite pattern?
I'm constantly playing with my pattern styles, and I have kind of a little black book full of designs that I've never actually attempted. A lot of them are mostly theoretical right now, based on knowing what a certain process is going to do to the material and how it's going to move to the design. I see things out in the world that I'm like, oh man, I think I could make a Damascus pattern out of that. But then I quickly sketch it out or take a picture, and then I go back home, and then I have to reverse engineer that process of how that would work, which is kind of, it can be really challenging at times, but, sorry to answer your question really, more concisely, you know, one of my favorite patterns still is, what I call a topography pattern. Most makers call it random Damascus, but I call it topography because random Damascus doesn't necessarily mean anything to a customer other than, sure, maybe the pattern's a little random, but to help give it more character, it looks like I'm looking at a topographical map. So I'm going to call it topography Damascus. But anyways, topography has always been a standard that I've always loved. I really like some of the more flowing mosaic patterns, like a explosion pattern, W's explosions, that literally look like explosions emanating from a certain pinpoint area. as well as so the way that I do my standard grinding my knives is a compound grind or an S grind. So that's a combination of a hollow grind above a convex cutting edge.
Yeah.
And when I forge a Sanmai style blade, part of that grind actually cuts down into that core material, revealing more of that core material. And at first, it really pissed me off, actually, because the kind of the idea is that you're protecting the core material with this cladding. But since the steel is all carbon, that's not necessarily the case. At that point, it's more aesthetics. And I realized, like, it kind of looks more like an Arctic coastline. And so that's what I've started calling that. It looks like little icebergs and islands off the coast of some craggy, icy, cold area or place, you know. So that's another fun one I really enjoy.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, the videos that you put on Instagram, I mean, they're all very sort of highly instructional, too. Do you find out that takes time away from producing knives, or is it just something that you can just do on the fly and carry on with work?
At first, it was really it could be very time consuming, but after a little bit of practice and I would say probably the most challenging part is just getting comfortable talking in front of a camera, even if it's your own camera pointing at your own face and you're holding it, it still can be challenging because in your mind's eye, you're thinking of all the people that possibly could be watching potentially later on and seeing your, at least me, my stupid face talking to people. But yeah, so it initially started out requiring a little bit more time, but as you know, it's a learning curve. And once you get the hang of it and you know, how to edit or if how to break down the video. I actually have stopped. I used to want to do a lot of editing. I do like almost zero editing now. And I think it's because part of that is because the real value isn't necessarily in the production quality, but in the actual quality of the content. Production quality is great and it is always going to enhance the content. But in a platform or a venue like Instagram, especially through Instagram stories, but as well as like when I'm doing a video that's more educational in a way or trying to be more informative, the information is what's most valuable.
Yeah, definitely.
And
yeah.
I could spend hours trying to edit myself and cut back and go back over and repeat things. But, you know, stumbling over my words, like I'm guarantee I'm doing already done a lot talking with you right now and I'll do more, but stumbling over your words and saying the wrong things and then having to back up and correct myself. Because I say words that have absolutely nothing to do with what I'm actually talking about. It makes the information that much more, I feel like more relatable, more, it brings a kind of a more of a human element to it instead of it being like so clean cut and overproduced. I think, if you can afford to take the time and do quality production, I say do it. But if you can't, that's okay too. I mean, again, it comes down to the value and the quality of the actual content that you're providing.
Tell me how you kind of got started doing knives. I know that you weren't a metal worker to begin with. What's your story?
It's a bit of a strange one, different to most people. But, you know, up until about 4 years ago, when I started making knives about 4 years ago, I'd always been a web designer. So, you know, for, you know, 20 odd years,
right.
I'm old. I'm really old.
You're not that old.
But if you do a job for over 20 years, you sort of become part of a community then, you know?
Right.
You know, and I love being part of a community. I love the support. I love the shared knowledge that a community brings and all that kind of stuff. So I started putting on various events and so on for designers, you know, starting with little conferences, you know, maybe sort of 200 people, growing to, you know, a few conferences a year with, you know, up to 1,200 people. You know, they're quite big events. People from all over the world would come, that kind of thing.
Wow.
I also set up like a co-working studio right in the middle of my home city, which is Cardiff, so people could come and work and collaborate, you know, teach and learn from each other. That also then turned into sort of a publishing company. So we're publishing design books from sort of high-end, you know, high-profile designers, which meant over time I was doing, you know, more and more admin and less creating. I wasn't really making stuff, you know, just firefighting, admin, that kind of thing. And to be honest, I wasn't really earning much money.
Right.
I was doing lots for the community, but, you know, struggling to make ends meet, really.
Right. So what and made it, you start to like get making things, like physically?
Well,
with your
hands? That's it's coming. It's coming.
Oh, sorry.
I mean, it wasn't healthy for me. That I think that's the main thing. You know, spending 14 hours in front of a screen 7 days a week, you know, it's probably not healthy for anybody. So I decided to do just one more event, which was a little different. So we hired a sort of retreat kind of venue, and you know, surrounded by acres and acres of woodland. And I put on what I was calling a summer camp for designers.
Wow.
So instead of the usual high-profile designers come in and, you know, speaking in a stuffy theatre, which was, you know, what I'd done for years before that, it was outdoors and, you know, attendees, that we'd come, we'd do workshops, we did, you know, screen printing, we did, you know, a making bread, we did a making beer workshop, just all hands-on stuff. But the favourite one was, you know, we all walked into the woods, we cut down a tree, and we all just carved spoons. It was like a, spoon carving workshop.
Huh.
And I loved it, you know, I thought, this is what I've been missing. I haven't made anything for so long. So going back then to the city centre office, you know, there's not really much scope for wood, you know,
yeah,
for carving wooden spoons, you know. So I started making stuff with what I knew, which was code, you know. So I'm making, you know, way before all these, you know, these Internet of Thing devices now, as they're called, you know, that turn on your lights from your phone and turn on your heat and that kind of thing. I was making these kind of things with little Arduinos and Raspberry Pis, that kind of thing. But obviously, to be a product, they needed some sort of housing, you know, some sort of, you know, something to put in to make it into a real thing. So, you know, you jump on YouTube and I'm looking at people, you know, vacuum forming plastics and making these intricate boxes and so on. And you know what it's like. You go down that YouTube rabbit hole, you know, where, you know, 6 hours later, you're still looking at people making these crazy things.
Yeah.
And I came across a video. I can't remember now, but I think it was probably a Walter Sorrells video, making a knife. So I was like, hey, I'm going to try making a knife. Made a knife and that was it. Had the bug, the sickness, you know?
Well, you didn't have any experience with metalworking in general before you did that.
None at all. So, you know, in school we did, you know, we made a bottle opener, that kind of thing, you know, but that was, you know, 25 years before this, you know?
Right.
Yeah. So it was quite a strange thing. So, you know, I was still running a design business, you know, and a co-working studio and an events business and, you know, publishing business. And, you know, I was making knives too on the side, which, you know, just for family and friends at that point.
Right.
But eventually, you know, I knew things had to change. I was, you know, I was working all these hours that, you know, God gave us. Didn't really enjoy it. You know, I wasn't really making any money. Health wasn't good. Stress levels were off the charts. And, you know, and my wife, who was my business partner, she's the smartest person I know. And, you know, and I knew this was just holding her back. These businesses, they weren't my dream, and they certainly weren't hers. So we decided to change everything. We shut the businesses down. We sold virtually all of our possessions. We jumped in a car and we drove to France and we decided to spend 2 weeks just looking for a house. And then we were going to start our new dream. So for my wife, which was to start her new business, which is sort of adult education, that kind of thing. And for me, just to be making knives. So that was just over 2.5 years ago. And we haven't looked back since.
Wow. So you sold everything and you drove to France?
We did.
What possessed you to go to France?
Well, you know, better climate than the UK. Not too far. So we could still get back and see family and friends. But, you know, cheap to live. The sun always shines. It was, you know, it made sense for us. And people thought we were crazy. You know, we had these businesses. And
I think you're crazy.
But everybody thought we were doing really well. But, you know, we weren't. We were just working all the hours. And, you know, it was just stressful. It wasn't good. And, you know, we weren't doing what we loved doing. So, yeah, we just hopped in a car and started a new life.
Wow. So just to jump back just a little bit. So you watched the Walter Sorrells video. Maybe you watched a couple of other you know, YouTube videos.
Yeah.
And then you just called up and bought some steel. And how did you heat treat? How did you do it all? You had minimal tools.
Yeah, well, very minimal. So I bought one of those, you know, those 1x30 little bandsaws, you know. It's not bandsaws, sorry, grinders.
Right.
Terrible things, but, you know, they did the job. I got a little devil forge, a little gas devil forge, which is, you know, only sort of 6 inches deep. It's a tiny thing.
Right.
And, you know, these first knives, they were Well, they were terrible, as you'd imagine.
They're supposed to be terrible.
Yeah, yeah.
The first ones are supposed to be terrible.
Well, it's not just the first one. I'd say for the first year, everyone was terrible.
The first 30 have to be garbage.
Yeah.
And that's the only way you can't really learn unless you actually kind of say, all right, next time I'm not going to do that.
Yeah.
So that's how you get to that point. So that's quite an investment from one Walter Sorrell's video.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. But it was that thing you just said about that first one, you know, it is terrible, the next 30 are terrible. But, you know, I'd probably spend a year and I'd probably make a knife every day for that time. And every time I made a knife, it was like, oh man, I just want to sort of recall all those old ones, you know?
Right.
And, you know, when I was making stuff with code, I could do that. I could just, you know, update all the code. Everybody's got right. the newest version. And it was just so frustrating that, you know, everyone was getting so much better, which is great. But then you've got these knives out there that you're just not happy with. So,
but those are also milestones in your life.
They are.
And I think that it's very important to see growth in regards to whatever you're doing. So, you know, if you're ever really truly satisfied with anything that you do, you're probably not really seeing what's really going on. So when I understand what you're saying, because I look at knives that I made and I say the same thing. I'm like, the next one's going to be better.
Hmm.
But you can't really go back. You got to like just look forward and know that the next one's going to be better. But other than that, I'm riveted by your story. So now you're in France.
Yep.
And now you're in France and now you bought a house. You and your wife's teaching adult education and then you're building up your shop.
Yeah. Still building the shop. Still building it. It's ongoing. But I did that thing that a lot of people do where you make it maybe your first sort of 30, 50 knives and you think, right, I'm an acceptable standard now, you know? So I get a website up and I start selling to the public. And 2 months later, you know, I'm discovering all these great knife makers on Instagram and Facebook and so on.
Yeah.
And you just think, man, I'm just, you know, they're in a different league. So what I did, so when I just mentioned, you know, you wish you could call them all back, you know? So I stopped. I took the website down. This was probably about 18 months ago. I took the website down for 4 months and I literally just spent every working hour in the workshop, just nailing these knives, just, you know, knife after knife after knife.
Right.
And, you know, I wasn't selling these. It was a very conscious decision that, you know, I've got a drawer back in the workshop with probably about 150 knives in there, you know? But each one was getting better and better and better. And it was only to that point where, you know, those gains started reducing. So, you know, I was happy with every knife, you know? I just sort of come to a happy medium. And that's when, you know, made a new website, start putting them up and started selling knives again. But I see that a lot. I see a lot of people making knives and, you know, they make, you know, 3-4 knives. Then next, you know, they're selling their knives and you just think, wow. I made that mistake too, you know.
Well, you know, that's very funny that you say that because I actually this is something I really wanted to talk about was, you know, in regards to, you know, when people first starting out making knives and different experiences and different things that your experiences are different than other people's experiences. And my experience is, you know, I started out as a sculptor and then I ended up working for a blacksmithing company. And I was actually I wasn't making knives until, you know, 10 years since I started blacksmithing. You know, I didn't even touch a knife until I was forging railings and tools and stuff like that. But I'd never made a knife until – I never forged a knife until years and years later. And it's interesting because my experience is different than your experience, which is different than a lot of your listeners' experience. And I don't think that – I think that all these different experiences are good. And being able to watch YouTube videos are good – and to be able to learn and just say to yourself, you got to do whatever it takes. Some people don't have access to certain equipment. Some people don't have access to certain techniques. And YouTube has become a resource that allows people to say, hey, you know what? I can make this. And maybe if somebody wants it, that's great. I think that it's really important. And I also back to what you were saying you saw these knife makers that made you think that your knives didn't look good. There are levels to this game. And as a knife maker or whatever, there really needs to be this, you know, appreciation of growth and figuring out, I got to do whatever it takes. You know, I live in an apartment. I can't have an anvil, you know, or I can't, you know, I want to make Damascus, but I don't have a power hammer. You know, there's levels to this game, and I think that it's very important to just kind of celebrate that growth and be supportive of, you know, people trying to do this kind of stuff.
Yeah, no, completely. And I have to say, if it wasn't for YouTube and seeing that first, I'm pretty sure it was a Walter Sorrells video. Yeah. That, you know, I would never have made that first knife, you know?
Sure.
And, you know,
no, it's exciting.
Completely. It's a new world, you know, and you're excited and, you know, you just want to be making knives all the time, and you have this big sort of equipment list of stuff that you think you desperately need. And it's this whole new world opened up.
Yeah, it's incredible. So now what's your next step?
Next step. Wow. Okay. Personally, I've been finding it very hard to live in, you know, a very remote area of France. Not in a city anymore. So it's very hard to sort of sell what I make. So quite often I'll go, you know, I'll take a flight or whatever to a big city, and I'll go around and I'll meet restaurants and I'll meet chefs. And, you know, we get commissions that way, and I start making knives, that kind of thing, which is great. You know, and I've been really fortunate enough to speak with, you know, lots of amazing knife makers on the show. And I often ask that very same question, like, how do you scale things up? You know, so running a business and chasing the dream of making knives every day, they're very different things, I think. And I've been giving this loads of thought over the last year or so. So I want to make a product. I want Chop Knives to be a product business, you know? So something that can be packaged up and maybe even sold in a store. But a product that's handmade but still affordable. So something that's going to be the same each time. Not exactly the same, obviously, because you'd be using slightly different materials for handles and so on. But the blade is, you know, the blade's going to be the same each time. So I'm going to start with a steak knife. You know, in my mind, what I think is the perfect steak knife. So for the past 6 months, I've been working on dozens of prototypes, which I've been, you know, making and taking to various restaurants to speak with the proprietors and chefs and so on for their opinion. And I want to make a knife that, you know, it's close to as perfect as you can get. And, you know, I think I've got this. So I've got a design which is beautiful to look at. It's razor sharp. You know, it cuts like butter. It's lovely. But as we all know, a handmade knife takes a lot of time. And this can make them, you know, too pricey for most people. So that's the challenge, you know, making something that's handmade, beautiful, does its job perfectly, but still affordable to most people.
Right.
So I've been visiting factories over Europe for the last few weeks to talk to them about my plans and, you know, take as many tips as I can from them of how they set up their sort of production lines. So I think I've got a solution. I'm going to produce these knives by buying steel in bulk straight from Sandvik. So I use a 14C28N stainless. I get the steel cut to profile with water jets. And I know a lot of people may think, well, you're not making a knife. But, you know, this is a blank. This is, you know, it has no bevels. It's literally just cut to shape. And that's the bit for me that takes the most amount of time, you know? To get things precise every time, that takes a lot of time. Not too much skill, strangely. It's just time.
It's time.
Yeah, so I cut down that time to manufacture massively, you know? So I still hand grind the bevels, I still stabilize my own wood, still make my own mosaic pins. Now, you know, I do all the heat treating in-house, but all of those actions can be done sort of in bulk, really, you know?
Right.
So I've even remodeled my studio to accommodate for sort of a factory-like production line. So each knife is then going to get the attention it needs, you know, from the final fit-up. And I think this is the kind of thing that a big factory can't really do because, you know, maybe they're using robots or whatever they're using. But I'm using natural materials, particularly for handles and so on. You know, and they're never uniform. So, you know, by doing this by hand, I can make sure that every single knife then is, you know, it's perfect, it feels good in the hand, and it's, you know, it's sharp as a razor. They're all hand-sharpened too. So today I've launched an Indiegogo campaign where people can order a knife or a set of steak knives, and that's going to really sort of kickstart the production.
Wow.
So that's what I've been working on.
So they're pre-ordering. People will be pre-ordering your knives.
Well, I'm ready to go. So the last 6 months, this is what I've been doing. So I've been taking very few sort of customer orders. The workshop has been completely remodeled, so I can just work on batches after batches after batches. So in essence, I suppose it's pre-ordering.
That's it. Oh my God. It's unbelievable.
We mentioned scaling things up, right? So, you know, as you know, a handmade knife, you know, even if it has been profiled by a water jet, it still takes a lot of time.
Yeah.
You know, for particularly sure. if you're aiming for the, you know, the kind of quality which I'm aiming for. So I think I can produce maybe a dozen to 15 knives on my own per week. You know, which is fine.
That's fair.
But it's not, you know, it's not production line, you know?
Right.
But my little tiny village here in France, it's got one of the oldest forges in Europe. But sadly, it's no longer a forge, it's a museum. You know, still has a forge, it's set up as a forge, but it's now just a museum. But what it does mean is that I'm surrounded by lots of fourth and fifth generation knife makers, you know?
Right.
And they've all now turned their hand to farming. They're struggling. You know, the demands of, you know, mass production in the farming world, it's very hard on a small, small farm. So if I need to produce more than a dozen or 15 knives per week, which I'm hoping is the case, you know, I've got skilled knife makers on tap. You know, and who knows, maybe I can get, you know, my little town making knives again. You know, that would be something worth working for.
This is like a movie. This is like one of those Irish movies where you bring the factory back. And
but it's happened in lots of villages around France, you know? And the French have got a rich history. So, you know, La Guillon knives, that's a very small village in France. You know, Thiers, you know, very similar there. Openel. Huh. Openel isn't the village, but the actual village, you know, it's all the local people making knives there. So
wow.
It's happened before in France, and I've got big ideas.
So that's incredible. I love the whole story, and I love the idea of what you're doing. And I wonder. I'm just curious, but just because I don't know, I know a little bit about Kickstarter, and I know about so for the Indiegogo. Do you have a set goal that you need to make in order for this to happen, or
it's slightly different with Indiegogo to Kickstarter? So. With Kickstarter, you say, let's say I need 10 grand for this to happen.
Right.
If you don't get backing up to 10 grand, it doesn't happen. Simply, right. you don't get any money and nobody gets any of the rewards, you know? But with Indiegogo, it's slightly different. So let's say I say, well, actually, it's 7.5 grand. That's what I'm saying in euros that I need for this to happen. But if it doesn't happen.
It's not a lot of money.
It's not a lot of money. But if this doesn't happen, people will still get those rewards because then I can just simply hand grind them anyway.
Right.
You know?
Right. Okay, great.
Because
right,
if it doesn't,
so if you're putting in for some steak knives, you're getting them.
Yeah, and the thing is, if it doesn't happen, that's because I haven't got to the volume that I require. So if it's not getting to that volume where I need to produce these in that way, I can just produce them how I've normally made knives anyway. So it's a win-win. You know, it just works either way.
Wow, I like this idea. I like this idea very much. You know, my business model is similar in the sense that we do a lot of pre-ordering, so I don't use Indiegogo, but like when we do chef series knives, if I do a series of 12, we pre-sell them before I make them.
Yeah.
And usually I'll start making them once we've sold four. Like if we can sell four of them, then I'll start to make them. And then, you know, that'll make my life a lot easier because then no one's kind of dumping money down
to
get these rolling. And then they're guaranteed for the thing. Well, I think it's great, and I heard a little something in your voice when you were talking about the handmade thing, and it's there. Like I was saying before, there are levels to this game,
yeah.
And sometimes you have to do whatever it takes. And I once had an old knife maker come into my shop, and I was grinding a bevel, and I had the table on the platen on the grinder, and I actually had clamped my knife to a very square 2x4. And then I was using that 2x4 as my guide just to keep myself at the same level when I was grinding. The first thing the guy said is, "Oh, you're cheating." And I was like, "What are you talking about?" He's like, "Oh, you should be doing it freehand." And I was just like, you need to leave. This is, you know, you have to do whatever it takes. Efficiency and taking some little steps out of this process allows you to kind of focus on the things that really matter. And part of that mattering is being able to provide something for people at a reasonable price and to have your sincerity involved.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I asked that question on Instagram. I did sort of an Instagram story, when is a knife handmade? And I said, if it's been profiled on a water jet, is it still handmade? And it was amazing, actually. So I'd say probably 95% said yes.
Yes, it is handmade.
Yeah, yeah. But those who didn't, they were sending me a message as to say why they think it isn't. And they were all very, very sort of valid reasons. But, you know, how far do you go to handmade? You know, are you sort of smelting your own steels? You know,
well,
where does that go, you know?
Well, that's the next thing. Because, you know, that's interesting that you say that too, because recently I was making some integral knives. I was forging some integral knives, and I posted a picture of me forging the integral knives. And somebody had responded with, "It's great to see somebody actually forging their knives like they used to," because, and I'm paraphrasing. I don't really remember exactly, because now people just grind knives out of, you know, they just take a piece of steel and they grind knives out of it.
Yeah.
And what I had said, and that's an old, you know, that's actually the elephant in the room in regards to a lot of knife makers and bladesmiths, and whether you're calling yourself a knife maker or a bladesmith, is this concept of stock removal versus forging. And a lot of people, this guy had basically said, yeah, forged knives are where it's at. And I said to him very, you know, with peace and love, you know, there's nothing wrong with stock removal knives. Some of the best knife makers in the world make stock removal knives. And I'm not going to name them out, but you'd be shocked. And
yeah,
there's
yeah.
nothing wrong with it. So you get to the point where you're asking, what's the difference? What's the gain in regards to being able to provide something for a customer that's of a high quality steel? You know, Bob Kramer gets a triple beam balance to make his steel, and he uses powder, and he, as you were saying, he smelts it down in an induction furnace. You know, you there are certain levels that you just can't do. And if you're able to do stock removal because what you're trying to provide is something affordable, if you're trying to do stock removal because you feel like you will get a better product, like say with stainless steel, sometimes you're going to get it for, if you have to make a 9-inch chef knife with a 2-inch heel, you really got to work like a dog to forge a knife that long, especially if it's stainless steel, it's a whole production too. So where are your gains and where are your losses, and how can you be as efficient as possible and provide a product to someone who wants to buy your knife, a friend of yours, a family member, whatever, and not say, I want to buy your knife, but I don't have $3,000. You know, it's like that's the issue.
That's that there's levels of consumer, right? So you've got, you know, you've got the $40,000 Bob Kramer knives. You've got the, you know, a couple of grand, you know, if you look, I think it's theforge.com where they take people's knives, you know, very high end knives, and they sell them. I think they're based in Dubai. But they're, you know, they're sort of $2,000-$4,000 knives. You know, you've got the sort of high end store knives, which may be, you know, sort of $300-$400 or whatever.
Right.
And then you've got, you know, you've got the shit. You've got the, you know, the Chinese press stuff, you know? So there's levels of consumer. And I think as long as you're being completely honest with the consumer, they know what's what.
Exactly. That's the most important thing. It doesn't really matter what your level is as a blacksmith or a bladesmith or whatever. It's the concept of being, you know, genuine and sincere and giving someone, you know, what you believe in it, and you want them to believe in you.
This show is brought to you by The Makery, the podcast network for makers.
Save big on your Memorial Day barbecue, all in the Kroger app. Get 3-pound rolls of juicy 80% lean ground beef for $3.49 a pound with a digital coupon. Then get select varieties of flavorful Powerade, Body Armor Super Drink, or Arizona Tea for 77 cents each, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.